The Moth is brought to you by Progressive. Progressive helps you compare direct auto rates from a variety of companies so you can find a great one, even if it's not with them. Quote today at progressive.com to find a rate that works with your budget. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations.
Support for The Moth comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/moth. That's odoo.com/moth. Odoo, modern management made simple.
Denver Moth, you guys did it. We won the 2016 Battle of Slams. Congratulations.
Welcome to the Moth Podcast. I'm Betsy Lamberson, the Moth Denver Story Slam producer.
And I'm Kevin Carlin, host of Denver Story Slams.
This time last year, we had our first ever Moth Battle of the Slams, a friendly competition between all the local slam cities around the country to see which city would be crowned our fundraising champ and help the Moth flame keep burning, because we slammers love a good competition. So today, Kevin and I are excited to share three stories on the podcast, each from a Denver Story Slam or Grand Slam.
Our first story comes from Andrew Overdahl. One of the great things about the Moth Story Slams is that every show we have at least a couple people who are doing it for the first time ever. They've never told a story before. And it's in front of a crowd of 300 people. Like, that's a big crowd for your first time. It's scary, but it's also super rewarding because it's such a great crowd. I mean, that's the crowd to try it in front of, because you can do no wrong in front of them. They're so supportive. So Andrew's story, I love this one because it sort of speaks to that rush of stage fright that we're all familiar with. And Andrew shared this story at our inaugural slam, where the theme of the night was, of course, firsts. Here is Andrew Overdahl.
In April of this year, I got an email through my personal website from a guy who said that he booked The Tonight Show in New York City, and he asked me if I wanted to make my stand-up comedy debut on The Tonight Show, and I immediately thought, this is a cool prank. There's no way that this is a real thing. And I asked my manager at the time, I was like, is this a real guy? Is this like a real thing? And he's like, yeah, of course it is. Like, how stupid could you possibly be? Yeah, respond to him. So I responded to the guy, and over the course of months, I had to keep sending him tapes of me doing comedy. We whittled the set together, and then I just waited around, and I was like, I guess he didn't really like what he heard. And then last Thursday, when I woke up, I got a phone call first thing in the morning from a New York area code, and it was that guy from The Tonight Show. And he was like, hey, this Monday, do you want to come to New York City and tape The Tonight Show? And I was like, what? I just woke up. I think I'm still dreaming. Like, what's happening? I'm going to fall down the stairs. Like, I don't know what's happening. I was like, yeah, I do. And so right then, they flew me to New York City like that Sunday. And they were like, you have to practice your jokes on Sunday in New York City. You need to go out and you need to rehearse your jokes. So I went out to different comedy clubs and I practiced my jokes. And at the last comedy club, the last show I did, they didn't like any of my jokes. They liked the comedians before me and they liked the comedians after me. They didn't like me at all. So I just ate it, and that's how I got pumped up to do a Tonight Show taping. It's just eating it and feeling terrible about every joke. And then I went back to the hotel and I was like, oh, I think I'm making a terrible mistake. And I went to sleep. And the next morning I woke up and it was time to tape. And I've never been skydiving, and I never want to go skydiving. And hopefully I never will, unless someone drugs me and tricks me into doing it, which I don't think you can do. But I feel like the nerves I had of this day were probably akin to skydiving. I was worthless. I couldn't eat any food. I couldn't have a conversation with someone because like halfway through the conversation, I would just sort of like fade off and just like mentally picture myself like tripping on stage in front of all these people watching me on TV. I was like garbage. And then it was time to go to the studio and actually record it. It was at 30 Rock, which I've seen on the show 30 Rock. And I was like, oh, I know this place. I've seen it so many times. I was like, wait, I've never been here before. I just think that I know it. I've never actually set foot in here. And so it's time to get ready. They put me in the makeup chair. They put so much makeup on me, I look like a replicant from Blade Runner or something. And then a hairdresser came in and she was like, she looked over my hair and she's like, do you want some coverage? And I was like, I don't know what that means. What does that mean? And she's like, well, we have like a spray fiber that we would like put on certain areas. She's trying to be as delicate as possible. I'm like, oh yeah, for the bald parts of my head. And I was like, And ultimately, I said no. I was like, no, I guess not, because like I can't be on TV with like a lush head of hair and then a week later be in a comedy club and they're like, oh, he got so sick after that after that appearance, something horrible had happened. So then I'm all done up, and then I just have to like wait. And this is like the plane climbing altitude, basically. I'm just like pacing, and I'm like, my life is gonna be different after this. Like, my life is not gonna be the same after this. I'm just like, that's like the thought in my head. I'm like, my life is gonna be different after this. And then they come and they're like, it's you, it's your turn. Come back here. And they take me back behind the curtain, and it's all dark, and I'm like, holy shit. Like, we're at altitude. I have my parachute on and my goggles and everything. There's a big guy and he's holding the curtain and he goes, 20 seconds. And he says it in a voice like a special forces soldier or something, just like 20 seconds. It's like the door of the plane just opened and the wind is like rushing in. It's time to jump out. I'm like, I don't know if I can do this. And then they introduce me. They open the curtain and I have to like walk out there. And I realize in hindsight that the director of the show has positioned himself right behind me. And there's a big part of me that thinks he would have pushed me if I didn't go right out. Like, he would have been like, you're going out. You're not going to hide behind the curtain. So I go out and I find my mark. And I may as well have just fallen out of a plane the way that I'm approaching this mark. The mark is a brass three-leaf clover inlaid into the floor. You're not supposed to step on it. You're supposed to stand 1 foot to the left, which I'm trying to gauge a foot as I'm walking up. Like, how big is a foot? I don't know. Picture a hot dog next to this clover. Like, don't fuck this up. And then I start speaking, and I'm like, oh my God, I'm talking, I'm doing it, and I'm still alive, and this is happening. But the problem is, I am terrified. There are parts of my body that are no longer responding. My microphone hand is locked up like this. It's like, it's done moving. All the joints have fused together, and it's done. And at one point, I reach over with my free hand, and I'm trying to manually, like, winch it down. Like, relax, mannequin, what's happening? Also, from time to time, with my free hand, I'll reach over and just gently touch the tip of the microphone as if to just reassure myself that I'm holding a microphone. I don't know. But there's the weird thing. The crowd is really enjoying it. They're clapping like they're at a magic show and they've never heard sentences before. It's ridiculous. They're like devaluing the currency of the applause break for me. It's amazing. And then it's over. Just as fast as it started, it's over. Like, oh my God, I'm on the ground. The parachute's laying around me. I pee everywhere. Almost. I would have peed if I had jumped off a plane. And then I'm back in Denver, and it is over just like that, like a whirlwind. And then I've been recognized one time from being on TV since then. I was at Target 5 minutes before closing, buying a broom and 4 boxes of macaroni and cheese. And an employee walked by me, and she's like, hey, you did a great job on the TV the other night. And I just started laughing, and I was like, I guess my life is different. Thanks, everybody.
That was Andrew Overdahl. Andrew is a stand-up comic, writer, and actor based out of Denver, Colorado. He created the hit storytelling show, The Narrators, and you can see him on his show, Those Who Can't, on True TV. For more information on Andrew and his endeavors, visit 5unicorns.com. Madeline Berenson is our second storyteller today. Madeline's a regular at the slams, and she won the night with this story. The theme of the night was busted. And there's something about the way she tells the story that makes me just want to curl up with a cup of hot cocoa and a blanket and listen to a bedtime story. Here's Madeline Berenson, live at the Moth.
I grew up in such a big family that the kids in my family were divided into two major groups, the big kids and the little kids. And I'm the second oldest, so I was one of the big kids, and I was actually quite proud of that because it was much cooler to be a big kid than a little kid. We big kids were innovators and leaders, and we did super cool things like spy on neighbors and cheat at Monopoly, whereas the little kids mostly just sat around, you know, eating paste and shitting themselves. So much more cachet in the big kid group. One of our favorite activities as big kids was scaring the little kids. And I'm not really sure why we liked doing it as much as we did, but we did it a lot, and we were actually quite good at it. I was probably the best at it, and I'm proud of that. And I'm actually better at scaring little kids. I'm still really good at it, actually. I'm better at scaring little kids than I even knew that I was. And case in point, 1967, when I was 8 years old, my brother Peter, who was 6 years old and also a big kid, and I were exploring some dark, navigated corner in our basement, and we came across this box, and in the box were these two horrifying masks that we had never seen before, one of a witch and one of a werewolf. And they were so realistic. They weren't like grotesquely exaggerated and comical like Halloween masks. They looked real. Like, they looked like a real witch and a real werewolf. And as we held these things in our hands and felt the weight and import of them, we both simultaneously had the exact same idea, which was these would be awesome for scaring the little kids, you know. And as we let that feeling kind of wash over us, we realized that if we were strategic and smart about it, we could reach new ground. We could go beyond scaring and actually downright terrify the little kids. And so that was our goal. And we set about, I was actually the leader. I know it's bragging, but I was the leader in this. And we set about the next 3 days. We took 3 days to put this plan together because we didn't want to do something ordinary and waste the potential of these masks. So we didn't want to just put them on like wearing our pajamas and jump out from behind the couch. We wanted to transform ourselves into an actual witch and an actual werewolf. So we sourced unrecognizable clothing from our parents' closets and assembled the most amazing costumes. Actually, we prefer the word disguises because costumes is sort of, you know, doesn't do it justice. We even like found hand coverings and shoes that nobody would ever associate with us. And we put them all in a box. And once we had assembled all the pieces of our disguises, the plan was this. That Saturday night, as soon as the house was dark, Peter was going to sneak into my room, we were going to put on our disguises, and we were going to creep up the hallway into our little brother Charlie and Tony's room, who were 5 and 4 at the time, and we were going to loom over their beds and awaken them from slumber and terrify them. And this was such a delicious prospect that it was actually really good that it took 3 days because we really got to stretch out the anticipation. And my favorite part about this plan in retrospect is that that's where it stopped. Like, it never occurred to us to think about what we might want to do once our parents had been awakened by our screaming brothers in the middle of the night. It just never even occurred to us. I mean, we would just get to that point where they were so terrified and we would dissolve into sinister laughter and, you know, we'd wipe our hands together. It was just like, perfect. Why go anywhere else? This was nirvana. So anyway, the night finally came. The night came and everything at first went as planned. The house was quiet. Peter snuck into my room. We started putting on our disguises, and I have to tell you, we looked exactly like a witch and a werewolf. I mean, if we scared ourselves, we'd look at each other and just be like alarmed at how frightening we were. And the pièce de résistance, the best part of both of our costumes was this scarf that I found that was navy blue with white polka dots. And I'm 57 years old. This has been almost 50 years, and I still remember this scarf. And it was so brilliant because it covered the top of the mask. And it covered my telltale hairline, and I tied it over the top of my head. And not only did it serve to disguise these, you know, recognizable aspects of the disguise, but it looked exactly like the kind of headgear an actual witch would wear, so it was super true to form. And anyway, we were all done, and we started walking up the black and white checkered hallway, and with every step we took, we got deeper and deeper into character, and we were lifting our hands higher and higher, and we got to their door, and we slowly opened it, and I started cackling, and Peter started growling, and all of a sudden, this huge, looming, dark figure arose from Tony's bed and turned to us and said, "You two get out of here right now!" And it was our mother, who had apparently fallen asleep while reading Tony a story. Well, I don't have to tell you what a code red situation this was. It was bad, and there was nothing to do except run back to our rooms, strip the costumes, jump under our covers, and pull the blankets up. I mean, we're talking wooden spoon material here. This was bad. So we were the ones who ended up getting terrified, right, waiting for her to come in and exact our punishment. But she didn't. She didn't come in. And then the next day we thought, well, we better tiptoe around this and not mention it because she has forgotten and we don't want to remind her. Nothing happened the next day. So we got away with it, except for the one piece of important information was that these beautiful costumes were wasted. And they were so realistic and so perfect, and they did not realize their full potential. Or so I thought. Because 3 years later, when I got punished for something I did not do and I did not deserve to be punished for, I had gathered my younger siblings around me and I was holding court talking about, "Mom's mean, Mom's unfair, I don't like Mom." And they were all listening to me, and my little brother Tony, who was then 7, piped up and said, "Mom's brave." And I said, "What are you talking about, Mom's brave?" And he said, "Mom's brave. One night a long time ago, a witch and a werewolf came into our room, and Mom told them, 'Get out!' And they ran away, and she wasn't even scared."
One more time for Madeline, huh? Madeline Berenson spent many of her early years moving from place to place. She grew up in different states in large houses far away from other people and packed to the rafters with oddities from the flea market. In other words, the ideal childhood for a writer, which is what she grew up to be, as well as a ski instructor. Madeline now lives in Eagle Vale, Colorado, with her adored and adoring husband David, is a mother and stepmother to 4 children and 2 dogs.
Story crafting can be really difficult sometimes, and the hardest thing can be getting it down to 5 minutes for a story slam. And what I love about Madeline's story is her ending. She completely nails it on how to cut off a story.
Yeah, the ending is very strong. And sometimes when we're going through the rules, and one of the rules is make sure that it's a story, and we remind people, make sure it has a beginning, a middle, and an end, and especially an end.
Yeah. And with that, our final story today comes from Harry Fleener. Harry is the oldest storyteller at The Moth, and in a few weeks, he'll be turning 97 years old. A couple notes about the story. During his story, the mic stand kept sliding down to about the middle of his chest, and you'll hear where he had to adjust it. Harry told the story at the Denver Grand Slam, where the theme of the night was fish out of water. Here's Harry Fleener, live at The Moth.
When I was 7 years old, back in Parker, Kansas, my dad ran the newspaper there, and we lived on a farm about a mile out of town. And every day, he took me and dropped me off and went on into town. Now, I'd never lived on a farm before, so all of the farm boys in school told me about how wonderful the farm was. And they told me about a word I never heard called sex. Now, not only that, but they told me about the little blonde in the 2nd grade that would do it for a Milky Way. Now, I didn't know what... Am I all right?
Just give it a moment.
Am I normal? Anyway, at this time, Dad, this summer after that, and my dad would come out sometimes, and he'd have lunch with Mom, and then he'd jump in the car and go back to work real quick. Am I growing, or am I getting shorter? No. Hello? I'm having a hell of a conversation with this thing. Wait a minute. Now I forgot where I was. Well, anyway, on this particular day, Dad came home at noon, and we ate dinner, and I went out and played, and all of a sudden, 45 minutes later, the car was still there, and where was Dad? So I looked in the car, he wasn't there. So I ran in the house and looked all over in the house, and he wasn't there. By this time, I'm getting a little more frightened. I go out and look through the hen yard, run around there, not there, in the barn, in the corral. I look down in the pasture by the cow pond, wasn't there. I went back in the house, and I had missed a door and it was locked. And I knocked on it, bang, bang, Dad, Mom, where are you, where are you? Bang, bang, oh my God, they're inside dead. I know it, they're dead. They don't answer. So I kicked in, and kicked the door open and looked there on the bed was my dad and Mom naked. I really didn't appreciate looking at my mom naked. I don't know if you've ever had the experience, but don't. I don't recommend. No, I don't. So, anyway, my mind turned and tumbled, and I got scared, and I knew one thing. I didn't belong there. I ran out the door, and I ran up to the barn and sat down in the haymow, and I said, they were doing it. I know they were doing sex. What you do is you get in bed, a naked mom and dad, and you look at each other. So now I remember now what those boys in the fifth and sixth grade were trying to do. They were trying to get me in bed with a naked girl. Not only that, but I thought about it for a while, and I thought, well, hey, what they want me to do is get in bed with a naked girl, then I go and I got to earn 10 pennies, which is a hell of a lot of money, by the way, until I got a nickel to buy a Milky Way. Well, I'll tell you what I'd rather do. I'd rather be down at the pond fishing or chasing killdeer birds or seining in the buggy boys. So they want me, those guys. I go down and I got to give her my Milky Way? Forget it. Hey, right there I decided for my life, I am never, ever going to do sex the rest of my life.
That was Harry Fleener. If you've been to a Denver Story Slam, you'll know that Harry has such a rich past to draw stories from. He studied law and journalism, served in medical supply for the U.S. Army in World War II, and safe to say, he didn't keep that promise at the end of his story. Harry went on to father 9 children. Nowadays, Harry spends his time dancing, hunting, and attending local Toastmasters meetings, and is very proud to still work as a car salesman. Thanks, Harry. We can't wait to hear your next story.
That's going to do it for the podcast this week. Thanks to all of our Denver storytellers and listeners for making this happen, and to all of you for helping make the Battle of the Slams such a success. For more information on how you can donate and support The Moth, visit our website, themoth.org.
You can also find more information about upcoming slam dates there, too. And if you're in the Denver area for a slam, feel free to stop by and say hi. Until then, have a story-worthy week.
Kevin Carlin is a former stand-up comedian from Buffalo, New York. He started telling moth stories in New York City before moving to Denver, where he now lives with his wife and kids and works as a court stenographer. He has been hosting the Moth Denver Story Slams for several years and loves telling and hearing stories.
Betsy Lamberson is the local producer of the Denver Story Slam. She has told stories at the Moth main stage about her experience surviving a terrorist bombing. Originally from Casper, Wyoming, she currently lives in Denver with her 5-month-old son.
Podcast production by Timothy Lou Lee. The Moth Podcast is presented by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange.
Helping make public radio more public at prx.org.